Hello, and welcome to Aging Well, Finding Beauty in the Gray. I'm your host, Hugh Willard. Aging Well is a podcast for everyone in or approaching the retirement years. There's a lot to unpack here, apart from the financial planning component, and we'll do just that. We'll explore new interests, priorities, and goals, and finding purpose for ourselves and in our relationships. Join me each episode as I share stories and chat with guests learning to live their best next act lives. Welcome back, everyone, to Aging Well, Finding Beauty in the Gray. We are celebrating Earth Day 2023 on today's show. We are actually recording prior to April 22nd, of course, Earth Day, but you are hearing the show in the following days and weeks, which is actually quite fitting. We need the formal recognition of Earth Day each year to remind us, in the spirit of gratitude and stewardship, that each of us has a responsibility to care for our home, both for ourselves, but also for our neighbors and for the generations that follow after us. And of course, we know that this needs to happen each and every day. We don't get to pick and choose when to do the right thing here. I am so happy to welcome our guests, Dan Gardoki and Christine Caprio, more affectionately known as Cappy. Dan has dedicated his life to bringing his passion for and connection to the more than human world with people of all ages. As a teenager, he met a high school teacher who turned him on to naturalist and survival skills, wildlife tracking, and much more. In his late 20s, he and his wife, Kate, co-founded a Nature Connection nonprofit that he led and grew into a successful organization for 20 years. In 2020, he shifted his focus to nature-based consulting, training, and guiding via his business, Lead with Nature. Dan is a registered Maine guide and a certified wildlife tracker. He lives with his family in southern Maine, where he likes to trail run, play guitar, as well as both hunt and photograph wildlife. Cappy is a high school English teacher in southern Maine. She has worked for nearly 20 years as the district's alternative education coordinator. In this role, she has worked to create community connections to enrich her students' academic experience. She has worked for many years with Dan and his colleagues, who have developed field experiences that run the gamut from nature-based trust and team-building programs to map and compass workshops. Dan is a longtime inspiration and mentor of Cappy's. She has participated in his wildlife tracking apprenticeship twice, as well as various other classes. In addition to her work as a classroom teacher, Cappy is working towards an MFA in creative nonfiction writing, and that is actually where she and I have crossed paths. So I was very excited to be with Cappy in one of our classes together. She's doing that with a concentration in narrative medicine, and she's also working towards completing her 500-hour yoga instructor training with an emphasis on chair yoga and restorative yoga. When she's not doing a lot of homework, she spends as much time as possible outside with her beloved dog, Campbell. Dan, Cappy, welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
Well, pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Dan, I was hoping you would start us off by telling us more about your Lead with Nature business.
Sure. Happy to do that. So the past few years here, somewhere in my late 40s and now my early 50s, I decided to change gears and move away from running and the complexity of a growing nonprofit to kind of focusing back on the things that I really both wanted to be doing more and also acknowledging that I had some new skills and new things I could potentially offer to those who are interested. And those are more around kind of consulting and coaching and helping people grow their businesses, lead some of their nonprofits, et cetera. And that's work I used to just do on the side for fun while I was also trying to, manage a big staff and budgets and HR and fundraising and all that other stuff that you do as a nonprofit director. So interesting timing. I started in the winter of 2020, so also when a pandemic hit our world. So that was fascinating, and but still going, and end up doing a lot more online teaching than originally planned, but actually have enjoyed it quite a bit, like a lot of others. And I mean, really, I'd say if there's one thread that runs through most of my work queue, it's I've kind of realized that part of most of what I do is helping people think about new ways to kind of share space with other creatures on this planet, because like you said, this is a more than human world, right? And it's easy for us to forget that and to get caught up in our own kind of human focus and drama. And well, it makes sense, we're human. However, we don't exist in a vacuum, and this is a closed system, this planet Earth, and it has finite resources, and everything is connected. And we're learning that sometimes in easy and hard lessons. But in general, my goal here is just to remind us of that and to think about some ways we can engage and interact, and that we get to more understanding and appreciation for the rest of the world.
Absolutely. And so I imagine that you and your staff probably work across many different types of entities, groups, businesses, organizations.
Yeah, and just to clarify, it's just me. The other thing I decided was I
It's just
wanted to
you.
just
Okay.
be a single member LLC and see how long I could do this on my own, very much simplifying the process for me. And yeah, I work with everyone from just individuals looking for maybe a career change or to grow a side gig into a full-time business, or long-time directors and leaders of businesses and nonprofits who are looking to transition out of that field or into a new role. So I help people with all sorts of things like that in the consulting side of my work.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I mentioned in the introductions for you both, you both have shared many experiences together out in the wonderful world of nature. And maybe both of you can tell us some of the stories and in your experiences with wildlife tracking.
So I guess maybe one of the more, well, there were two sort of magical places. I think one was Jackman, where we were tracking lynx. And I think in particular, the first time that I had gone there, having never seen anything like that, having never seen a cat paw that big, that was a pretty impressive experience. And we had gotten really lucky, and we had seen some really good trails. And you had shown us, Dan had shown us how to make the casts with the wax. And we had seen some snowshoe hare. And we had another person who was participating. His name is Bob. And the snow was that perfect kind of crusty snow where he was actually able to, and Dan, I don't know if you remember this, but he was able to lift the track out of the snow and hold it up like a window into the sun. And it was just this perfect print, and it was just a beautiful place. Cedars, everything smelled good. There was marten. It was just incredible. And then I think another place, and Dan can certainly speak to these more, but Dan has a really close friend who has a home on Creehaven Island. And which is off the coast of Maine, and it's 3 hours up or something like that. It's a little bit north of Rockland. And it's a pretty remote space. And there were a lot of bird migratory, flyways and that kind of a thing. And I can remember distinctly seeing like a little scarlet tanager, drinking from like a tide pool, because it was so tired. And then also some eagles and some raptors. So those are two moments or places that stand out to me that Dan facilitated for our whole group.
I think you chose the right word when you said magical.
Yeah, that's awesome, Kathy. I totally remember those. And just to give a little context, so Yeah, Capio is part of a number of things that we've done over the years together. And one was this kind of three season, like, it was like a 9 or 10 weekend, consecutive weekends, once a month, where we would just immerse ourselves in, in this big old world of nature, mostly through the lens of studying the tracks and sign of wildlife. So birds and mammals, sometimes reptiles and amphibians, because a lot of these animals, sometimes we'd see them, but rarely. I mean, mammals tend to be pretty shy and mostly nocturnal. So one of the ways we learn to understand them is through, tracks and scat and scratches and rubs and dens and carcasses and kill sites and all sorts of fascinating behavior that they leave behind. And the weekend she was referring to with the lynx trailing, the Canada lynx is a pretty unique, interesting critter, and the western mountains of Maine are a very gorgeous place to basically strap on a pair of snowshoes, and follow the trail of this wild animal into who knows where. And we do kind of, and just have a day of exploring and letting that trail unfold in front of you and tell you the story of this animal, a little bit of its story in that day. And you just never know what you're going to find. And those days tend to be pretty fascinating and memorable, especially on a gorgeous day. And yeah, smells, sights, sounds, memories for sure.
Well, to be bundled up to stay warm, if you allow for that, it sounds really idyllic.
You definitely have to do that. Yes.
And Cappy's description, which was just so visceral and just it's right. I was right there as you described that, Cappy. I for our listeners, how big is a lynx paw, a mature lynx paw? I mean, I just have this image. So the I think you said Bob sort of scooped out with that perfect sort of crusty snow and was able to lift this whole print up. And I just have an image of that, but it sounds like the lynx has a pretty big paw. Would either of you speak to that?
Yeah, so if you picture like a saucer that might come with like a coffee or a teacup, or maybe
Okay.
5, 6, 8, depending on the track, depending on the conditions, it can be, the foot itself is probably closer to around 4 inches in diameter, both length
Okay.
and width. But the impression it makes with the big ring of fur, they have these huge furry feet, disproportionately large for their size, which gives them that special capacity to be able to really float on top of most snowy conditions, which gives them an advantage ecologically against other similar size carnivores who would be breaking through the snow. It also enables them to catch the snowshoe hare, which is the main part of their diet. But anyhow, they leave these massive tracks, just like the snowshoe hare does too, relative to their size. So it's just fascinating, especially if you're used to looking at bobcat tracks or cat tracks or something like that. It's kind of, yeah, very surprising when you first see it.
And I would love to stay on the celebratory side of things, but as both of you are speaking to this experience with the wildlife tracking, a thought comes to my mind. I'd heard this from Cappy before, actually, but a thought comes to my mind, and that is the effects of climate change and what that is doing to habitat, and how that might be affecting things. And are either of you noticing anything over the years with respect to that?
Well, I don't have that many years. I have those sort of 2 years that I was there, and they were only, I think, maybe 3 years apart. And I would say that they were fairly consistent in terms of what we saw for sign or for tracks. But I do know because they have those crazy snowshoe feet that they lose a bit of an advantage because there's other land predators that can outcompete them if there isn't enough snow for them to sort of travel on top of. But I think like this year, I believe we're two, Maine is 2 feet shy of our average for snowfall. So our weather is becoming more and more, I would say, I don't know if the word is erratic or less predictable, but I personally do worry about what's going to happen to some of these animals that have these more sort of specialized habitats as things change. And I know Dan has probably seen a lot more over a longer, he has more of a longitudinal view of these things maybe than I do.
Yeah, no, that's right on. I mean, I think stepping back, when we think about our challenges right now with climate change, I mean, really the issue, one of the biggest issues is the pace of change, right? Because I mean, our climate has been much, much colder and much, much warmer over the millennia. And as humans, we often forget we're such a new species on this planet that we have not experienced a ton of that change as a species. We've experienced some, but most of the wildlife we share the world with have been around eons longer than us, and they have dealt with very, very big changes. Now, the rate of change is the problem, because if you don't have time to adapt, that's where we'll see more and more die-offs. So that being said, as you know, as climate warms, the logical stuff that's happening and we're seeing is species that used to be more southern expand their range north. Species that required much colder, species that had more limited cold, boreal, Arctic kind of ranges or they're losing habitat because there's just not as much of that left. Right? We're seeing things melt like glaciers and permafrost. And so, I mean, like any change, it's relatively quote unquote good and bad. I mean, there's some species that are getting a tremendous bang for their buck. I mean, they're really doing well because, you know, they can do really well to a variety of conditions and they can do well in a variety of habitats. They can adapt quickly. Others, not so much. And Cappy referred to that with generalist species, such as actually bobcat and lynx are a great comparison. Bobcat are expanding and doing rather well. They can live in everywhere from deserts to almost boreal habitats. And whereas lynx, you know, Canada lynx can only live in places with very deep, consistent, long snow cover over winter. So higher elevations in colder, temperate regions. So, you know, birds are an interesting one too. One of the big challenges with the erratic weather is something we call ecological mismatch. So if you think about your typical, most people are hummingbird fans. And if, you know, if you imagine a time when there wasn't hummingbird feeders that we had out, they were very dependent on the certain timing of certain plants coming to flower and thus having nectar and things like that, right? So as birds are migrating in our hemisphere to the north in the spring, they're waiting, you know, they're timing that risky adventure such that, actually, I just looked out the window and there's a palm warbler that just landed in my yard, which is a new migrant. I haven't seen it yet this year in my yard. So that bird on its journey, luckily, it's pretty adaptable. Unlike the hummingbird, it can eat insects, it can eat seeds, but the hummingbird needs a lot of fluid, a lot of nectar, a lot of sugar. So if it migrates too early, or if all the flowers it's used to feeding on all blooms really fast and then die off, it can really affect that animal's survival rate and its chances of making it during migration. And migration, as many people know, is like one of the most intense physiological outputs. It's one of the most enduring, like endurance, crueling endurance events you can imagine. So a lot of these critters are already on really lean budgets. And so that ecological mismatch, that timing of flowering of plants and insects that pollinate those and birds that eat them is very significant for a number of bird species and can really do them in a migration season. There's just one example.
So last year we had for Earth Day, we had Dr. Mick Smyer on, and he is the founder and CEO of Growing Greener, Climate Action for a Warming World. And among other things, they do a lot of workshops, a lot of educational opportunities, and they have a real focus on intergenerational connection and engagement. And I have a sense that that is a focus for really both of you in your in the work that you do. Can you speak a little bit more to this? Cappy, you've got your kids.
I do. Yep.
Yeah.
I'm actually even thinking a little bit further back. You had asked about moments that Dan and I had sort of overlapped with tracking. One of the first times I actually ever met Dan was when I was working at an environmental ed center, and Dan came to participate in a citizen science event, which was called BioBlitz, and you did the mammal tracking. I think that was maybe 1999 or 2000. And I bring that up because it's still an event that the center has. And what that means is, so they're bringing in field naturalists and of all ages. So some people who've been professors of a particular, you know, dendrology or limnology, or someone who studies wasps, and they could be more advanced in their career, and then you've got little kids that they're working with. And so that is one experience that I had where connecting like younger kids to elders or people who could be mentors for them that have a lot more world experience. And then I do have my high school students, and that I've always wanted to try and bring them outdoors as much as I possibly can, because it really is, it's really interesting to me. There's so many kids who live in a really beautiful place, but they don't understand how to access it. And so they don't, And then there's a lot that they actually don't know that's in their own backyard. And so it's very important to me to try to show my students how to tap into that.
Yeah. And for me now, most of the way I do this is indirect. A lot of the consulting work I do is supporting leaders in this field, in the field of what we might call nature connection work, which is basically helping a lot of modern humans remember that we are part of a larger system. But for, you know, probably 25 years before this, I was directly working with children, families, youth, teenagers in the field, often helping them, you know, learn to both like identify and understand relationships and connect with and experience what it means to be out of a temperature controlled box, you know, to get wet, cold, hot, tired, uncomfortable, in the rain, the dark, the heat of the day, you know, like all those things, to show that we are a much more resilient species than we are kind of training ourselves to be these days. And there's a lot we learn through a lot of our senses out there. So that's what I was doing directly, and I would do it indirectly mostly.
What is ahead for each of you? You know, what are your plans? What are your hopes for the future?
I can go first for this too. So when I finish my schooling, when I finish and earn my MFA, I am really interested in combining nature experiences with writing and kind of seeing how those worlds can overlap in a, for lack of a better way of being able to explain it, in more of like a healing sense. So structuring workshops so people can come and have a nature experience and then have an opportunity to do the expressive writing and process some of their emotions sort of steeped in that environment. And so I don't know all of the pieces, like I don't know how that's all going to come together. There's still a lot of unknowns, but I feel like that is my next really big step, will be to leave a public school system and do something non-traditional, but still education and based in nature with writing.
Well, and I will echo for what Cappy is saying for her plans and interests for the future. I have had the great privilege of being able to read some of her writing, and she is a wonderful nature writer. And so I am excited for how that will turn for you and how many other folks are going to have opportunity to also be just be witness to and be able to receive the gifts of your writing. So
thank you, Hugh.
Dan, how about you? What's on the horizon for you?
Sure. In many ways, Hugh, I feel like this endeavor at Lead with Nature is still new for me, and it's, which is fun. It's fresh and it's exciting, and I'm excited to continue to grow my. Actually, I like to do diversity of things at once. I'm a bit of a multitasker, fast processor, energetic human. So right now, the trifecta I have going on is my consulting work, doing public workshops and talks and things like that. So I do a lot of work with, like, you know, free public access, you know, libraries, nature centers, walks, talks, this and that. And then the other third is I'm doing a lot of guiding, which is fun. I get to just take people out on little adventures, often the smaller groups, or, you know, even individuals or couples or families. And I really enjoy playing that role and showing them around and helping them understand and connect with some of those places. So yeah, I think that, but then also, you know, stepping out of my bubble and thinking about what's maybe more helpful or also helpful for the world, and, you know, thinking about how I can have more, you know, be more of an agent of change that I want to see. Continuing to find places to be of service and get the message out there to more people. So,
and just a quick Yes, and a quick clarifying question with your business Lead with Nature. Do you, as you describe some of the hands-on stuff that you do there, does that tend to be more concentrated in Southern Maine or in New England, or do you get further outside of the of those
I
regions?
mean, I think, yeah, just by location, it's mostly in this region of New England, but I mean, I travel and do work all over. It was a lot more before COVID and slowly getting back to that
Sure.
now. So yeah, I know I definitely have worked all over this continent. Hopefully we'll continue to.
Well, and yes, COVID has been obviously a difficult experience for many folks on many levels and in many ways. And it's something that's a part of conversations that I've had with numerous guests here on the podcast. And so it is a reminder, as you described, trying to start a business on the front side of that and then moving through that. So as we come to this time and as we orient forward, for both of you, I'm excited and interested for other folks to be just a part of experience and learning and maybe deepening insights and respect and compassion for all of nature. And so I'm excited that you all could join me here today on the show. I definitely want to continue to get this good word out about our need for stewardship, for learning and engaging and understanding more about our relationship with all of nature. Dan Gardoki and Christine Cappy Caprio, thank you both for joining us on the show today. We do appreciate it, and we wish you all the best in the time ahead.
Thanks for having us, Hugh.
Thank you so much.
Be well. Happy Earth Day, everybody.
You have been listening to Aging Well, Finding Beauty in the Gray. I am author, psychotherapist, and life coach, Hugh Willard. To learn more about this podcast, listen to other episodes, and discover resources related to our guests and topics, please go to our website, findingbeautyinthegray.com. If you have comments or questions, or would be interested in sharing your story with us, we'd love to hear from you. Please reach out to us at findingbeautyinthegray.com. Aging Well is produced by Willow Way Creations with sound engineering by Garrison Locke. Theme music is written and performed by yours truly with Greg McGee and Garrison Locke. Thanks everyone for joining us. We hope you will be with us again next week.